If you would, take your Bibles and turn to Genesis chapter 27, verses 1 to 45. We're going to look at the whole chapter this morning. Last week, we saw that Moses wrote Genesis 25 to the people of Israel who already felt defeated, and they hadn't even entered the promised land yet. God had promised them victory in the promised land, but they didn't feel like victors or conquerors. Every circumstance around them seemed to hold defeat for them. So Moses tries to encourage Israel, this lesser nation, the least of these, the people of God, that they would indeed be victorious. However, the people of Israel were not to assume that this victory would be easy. Rather, their overcoming of the enemy would require them to claw and to fight and struggle to obtain the promises of God. And we said that this was true for us as the church as well, that God has promised us victory over this world. God has guaranteed His promises to us, for all of His promises are yes and amen in Jesus Christ. However, we, like the people of Israel, are going to have to struggle and claw and fight to be like Christ. But we can be assured as God's people that we will be overcomers, that we have the victory in Christ. That because He has had victory over sin and death, then we too, because we're in Him, will also have victory over sin and death. We will receive all of His promises because God is faithful to His people. Now, in Genesis 27, Moses wants to encourage Israel that not only will God make them victorious, but that nothing can stop or derail God's plan of making them conquerors. Nothing can stop or derail God's plan of redeeming His people. In Genesis 27, God is going to promise that He will indeed redeem His people, that God will fulfill all of His promises. And not only that, but that even our own sin and deception inside of God's people cannot stop God from accomplishing His plan of redemption. God is unstoppable. Unlike the movie that came out not too long ago, Unstoppable, with Denzel Washington about a train, it eventually stopped. So maybe that's a misnomer. Apparently was stoppable, right? God, in this case, is unstoppable. He will continue and He will redeem His people. This is what Moses is going to show us this morning. God's redemptive plan will be accomplished in spite of our sin. So let's remember back to the context of the story that we looked at last week in Genesis 25. Abraham sent his servant back to his people to find a God-fearing wife for Isaac. In other words, he wanted Isaac to have a wife who was a believer in Yahweh. So he sent his servant on a 400-mile journey, and God directed this servant purposely to Rebekah. And when her family did not want her to leave right away, Rebekah volunteered to go with the servant immediately. And after a long 400-mile journey back, Rebekah sees Isaac off in the distance. She jumps down, she veils her face, and we have some type of love music playing in the background as she runs in slow motion towards Isaac, right? They embrace, and what we're to see there with the veil being pulled down is a wedding ceremony. It tells us that Isaac took her into his mother's tent, she became his wife, and we read these great words, and he loved her. He loved her. When Rebekah could not bear children, Isaac began to pray to God. He and Rebekah prayed for over 20 years, and then God heard his prayer and she conceived. But this pregnancy proved to be incredibly, excruciatingly painful. So Rebekah runs to God and prays again, and God speaks to her in Genesis chapter 25, verse 23. And he says, "And the Lord said to her, 'Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples from within you shall be divided. The one shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger.'" This was strange, especially in this culture, because the firstborn had significant advantages. The firstborn would inherit a double portion of the inheritance when a father would die. They would receive a special blessing from that father. Yet God declared that He was going to have the older serve the younger. For this to take place in this culture meant that God Himself was going to have to sovereignly intervene and cause some circumstance to happen, which would cause the younger to be ruling over the older. The story continued. Finally, the twins were born. Genesis chapter 25, verse 25. We read, "The first came out red, all his body like a hairy cloak, so they called his name Esau." Then the second child was right behind. Verse 26, "His hand was holding Esau's heel, so they So his name was called Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when she bore them. When the boys grew up, Esau became this skillful hunter in the field while Jacob became a herdsman and a businessman for his father. And then we begin to sense that something's not quite right in the marriage between Rebecca and Isaac. Verse 28 tells us that Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game, but Rebecca loved Jacob. We can tell something's not quite right in their relationship. This relationship, which started off so well, has begun to deteriorate. In the next scene, verses 29 to 32, we read, "Once when Jacob was cooking stew, Esau came in from the field and he was exhausted. And Esau said to Jacob, 'Let me eat some of that red stew, for I'm exhausted.' Therefore, his name was called Edom," red. "Jacob said, 'Sell me your birthright now.' Esau said, 'I'm about to die. What use is a birthright to me?' So then Esau sells his birthright for some stew." And we read in verse 34 that Esau despised his birthright. This is the first time that we see that Esau may not be worthy of being the firstborn and having a double portion of inheritance and being the blessed child, or being the seed of the woman who carries on the line of Christ. Later we see once again that Esau calls into question whether he is actually the seed of the woman or not, because in verse 34 we read, "When Esau was 40 years old, he took Judith, the daughter of Beri," nice, right? Beri, "the Hittite, to be his wife, and Basmath, the daughter of Elon, the Hittite." So Esau marries two Hittite women. Now, do you remember how adamant Abraham was that his servant not choose from among the people of the Canaanite lands? Not choose among the... As a matter of fact, he says, "Servant, I want you to do this. I want you to go, and I want you to find a believing wife from among my family. Go back to our homeland, 400 miles. And he says, "Well, what about the women who are right here?" And he says, "Don't even think about letting my son marry one of these women. These women are going to be dispossessed from the land. They're the Canaanites. They're going to be chased off. This is God's promised land, and you need to be a part of his redeemed people to maintain the land. Do not let my son marry into the people of this land." He says, "Well, what about if I find a girl there and she won't come back here? Should I just take him to be with her?" And he says, "Absolutely not, because this is where the promised land is. He's going to inherit the promised land. She's to come back here." But it appears that Esau gave very little thought, if any thought, to considering God's covenant promises when he chose his wives. Abraham didn't want the risk of Isaac losing the promised land by intermarrying among the Canaanites, and yet here we read that he simply acts on his physical appetites. He married not one, but two Hittite women. And again, he shows he's not worthy of the privileges of the firstborn. He's not worthy of being the seed of the woman. He's not worthy of representing God's people on the earth. But here's the rub, and here's where we really chafe as Christians. Jacob is not worthy of God's covenant promises either. So, who should be the person who carries on the covenant promises? Should it be the guy who marries the women who are next door who will dispossess the land? Or should it be the liar, deceiver, and cheat? You see, Jacob's not worthy of being the seed of the woman either. He's not worthy to inherit the promised land. He's not worthy of being a blessing to the nations. As a matter of fact, Esau will become a nation, will he not? Esau becomes the nation Edom. And Jacob is anything but a blessing to Esau. Rather, Jacob's a deceiver. And that's where our text picks up today in chapter 27, verses 1 to 4. It says, "When Isaac was old and his eyes were dim so that he could not see, he called Esau, his older son, and said to him, 'My son?' And he answered, 'Here I am.' And he said, 'Behold, I am old. I do not know the day of my death. Now then, take your weapons, your quiver, and your bow, and go out to the field and hunt game for me, and prepare for me delicious food, such as I love, and bring it to me so that I may eat, that my soul may bless you before I die.'" So Isaac's blind in this passage in more ways than one. Obviously, his eyesight has failed him. He can no longer see. He is blind. But he also cannot see that Esau's marriages to Hittite women have compromised the plan of God for inheriting the promised land. By marrying these women, he has not set himself apart to be a holy nation. He has not been set apart unto God. Isaac should have seen that his oldest son was not worthy of representing God's people. But Isaac pushes ahead blindly. Isaac, like Esau, is controlled by his physical appetite, so much so that Isaac and his dying wish are, I want some really good food. However, Rebekah overhears Isaac's plans to cut her son Jacob out of the will. So she acts immediately, and there's no time to waste. We read in verses 6 to 10, Rebekah said to her son Jacob, I heard your father speak to your brother Esau, bring me game and prepare for me delicious food that I may eat it and bless you before the Lord before I die. Now therefore, my son, obey my voice as I command you. Go to the flock and bring me 2 good young goats so that I may prepare them from delicious food for your father, such as he loves. And you shall bring it to your father to eat so that he may bless you before he dies. So the plan is simple. While Esau is out hunting to bring home game for his father, which should take some time, Rebekah is going to prepare 2 young goats for a delicious meal for Isaac. She's going to disguise it so that it tastes like game, and then Jacob can serve his father this deceptive meal and receive deceptively the blessing from his father. But Jacob himself sees a major flaw with his plan. He doesn't think his mother's quite thinking all clearly. Verse 11 and 12. But Jacob said to Rebekah, his mother, behold, my brother Esau is a hairy man, and I'm a smooth man. Perhaps my father will feel me, and I shall seem to be mocking him and bring a curse upon myself and not a blessing. You see, this is a huge risk for Jacob. If Isaac discovers what he's up to, if Isaac discovers that Jacob's deceiving him, Jacob will be cursed. Now think back in Genesis. How would the people of Israel have understood cursing? Jacob would be cursed like Cain was cursed and removed from the chosen people of God. Never to be a believer, never to repent of his sin and return to God's chosen people. They would have been thinking like the descendant of Ham. Ham mocked his father, did he not? Standing at the tent, he mocks his father, and then all of his descendants are cursed and removed from the people of God, never to have fellowship with God again. Jacob is concerned because he's the spiritual leader in his home. See, he doesn't just deal with business. The goal of this herdsman is to take over his father's dealings. And now his father is blind and he's sick and he's dying and he can't spiritually care for the family. So not only is he working the business for the family, purchasing and selling of animals, but taking care of the fields and everything else. We also know he's supposed to be leading the family spiritually. And he recognizes that if his father recognizes what's happening to him, that he'll curse Jacob and Jacob will forever be removed from the people of God. Now remember who this is being written to, the people of Israel getting ready to enter the promised land. They'd be gasping at this point because that means that if this happens, they're not God's chosen people. They're not going to inherit the land. They're on the edge of their seat. To add even more depth to the story, the people of Israel getting ready to enter the promised land knew the law. Deuteronomy chapter 27, verse 18, cursed be anyone who misleads a blind man on the road, and all the people shall say, amen, or I agree. Cast away from the people of God is anyone who tricks a blind man. But Rebekah is so set on getting the promised blessing for her favorite son. Now think about the obsession she must have with Jacob. She ignores Jacob's concern and says in verse 13, let your curse be on me, my son, only obey my voice and go and bring them to me. If this goes south, she says, I'll depart from God's people. You can put the curse on me. How not clearly is she thinking? How unclear is her mind at this moment to be cast away from the people of God? All to connivingly get her son a blessing that God has already promised if they will wait, because God has proven himself to be faithful. So Jacob obeys his mother, brings 2 young goats to Rebekah and watches as she carefully prepares them for Isaac. However, there's another problem. Even if Isaac believes that goat stew is game stew, and how in the world is Jacob going to trick him into thinking that a smooth-skinned man is a hairy-skinned man? But Rebekah has another plan. She takes some of Esau's clothes and puts them on Jacob, and then she takes some skins of these young goats and puts them on his hands and neck. How hairy must have Esau been? She literally takes the skin of a goat and puts it on his neck and hands, and that's about right. Because when Jacob, or when Isaac feels Jacob, he says, "The hand of my son Esau, but the voice of my son Jacob." Finally, she gives Jacob this prepared food, and she sends Jacob in to meet with Isaac. Now, can you imagine the thoughts that must be racing through Jacob's mind right now? If this was a movie, it would be a cliffhanger. I mean, we would just be on the edge of our seats, because imagine everything that's going through his mind. Will this deception work? Am I going to be cursed by my father? Will the goat skin fool my dad? Will he taste the difference between wild game and goat stew? And oh, by the way, when do you think Esau is going to come back into the tent? All this is pressing on him, but even with those thoughts racing through his head, he now, with the help of his mother, is in the presence of his father Isaac, and there's no turning back. Verse 18, so he went into his father and said, "My father," and he said, "Here I am. Who are you, my son?" So here's Isaac's first test. The question is, who are you? Jacob's ready for this pop quiz. Verse 19, this is an easy one. He said to his father, "I am Esau, your firstborn. I have done as you've told me. Now sit up, eat of my game, that your soul may bless me." I don't know if you can tell the quickness of these words. It basically is, I'm in a hurry. I can't wait to get out of here. Let's get this over with. Come on, Dad, sit up, eat this quick. Bless me. Hurry up. Esau's on the way, right? He's in a hurry. But Isaac's not in a hurry. This is maybe the last thing that he does in all of his life. He doesn't know when he's going to die, he says. He's right on the brink of death. He can't see anymore. He's having trouble hearing. He's laying on his deathbed. Isaac's not in a hurry. Verse 20, it says, "But Isaac said to his son, 'How is it that you have found it so quickly, my son?'" And this is Isaac's second test. Jacob thinks quickly. He hadn't planned on this one, wasn't prepared for the question. And he answers, "Because the Lord your God has granted me success." Are you kidding me? Jacob uses God's name, Yahweh, to promote his own sinful deception of his father. This is nothing short of blasphemy. In addition, Isaac's still not convinced that this is Esau. Genesis 21, he says, "Please come near to me, that I may feel you, my son, to know whether you're really my son Esau or not." So this is Isaac's third test. So Jacob slowly approaches his father. He reaches out his hand for Isaac to feel. And now Isaac wavers again. He's still not sure. Verse 22 and verse 23, we read, "The voice is Jacob's voice, but the hands are the hands of Esau." And the narrator adds in verse 23, "And he did not recognize him because his hands were hairy like his brother Esau's hands, so he blessed him." Isaac again wavers in this blessing on the fourth test, verse 24, where he says, "Are you really my son Esau?" And he answered, blatant lie, bold-faced lie, "I am." Verse 25, then he said, "Bring it near to me." That's the red, or the game stew, right? "Bring it near to me that I may eat of my son's game and bless you." So Jacob brings the meal to Isaac, and he eats and he drinks, and somehow he doesn't notice that he's eating goat meat instead of game from the field. But now it's all taking too long. Jacob's sweating. Esau could enter the tent at any time. Jacob's deceit is going to be discovered. We should be really feeling this tension in the story now when we read verse 26. "Then his father said to him, 'Come near me and kiss me, my son.'" And this is Isaac's fifth test. Jacob's heart must have just been beating out of his chest. You know, it would be like you could put your hand on his chest and feel his heart inches away, right? Just beating out of his chest. Jacob draws near and he kisses his blind father. And when Isaac smells the scent of Esau's clothes, he's finally convinced it must be Esau. And he blesses Jacob. And Isaac exclaims in verse 27, "See, the smell of my son is as the smell of a field the Lord has blessed." And then he pronounces this threefold blessing on his son. First, the fertility of the field, verse 28. "May God give you the dew of heaven and the fatness of the earth and plenty of grain and wine." So there's a blessing. And there's a second blessing in verse 29, the first part of 29. Let people serve you and nations bow down to you. Be Lord over your brothers and may your mother's sons bow down to you. And then there's a third blessing. It's blessings and curses. Cursed be everyone who curses you and blessed everyone who blesses you. This last blessing should be bringing up in our minds Genesis 12 and 15 and 17. It echoes the blessing that Abraham received. This third blessing, Jacob's not only blessed, but he's to be a mediator, a blessing to other nations. He's to mediate God's grace to other people. This is a blessing in the midst of being ungracious, of being deceitful. Now Jacob has his threefold blessing and he leaves the tent as quickly as possible. And just as Jacob's leaving, I mean, if you can see this in a movie, just as he rounds the corner, his brother rounds the corner into the kitchen. He's come back with his kill from the field. And the narrator tells us in verse 30, as soon as Isaac had finished blessing Jacob, when Jacob had scarcely gone out of the presence of Isaac, his father, Esau came in from his hunting. Then Esau prepares a meal for Isaac and he brings it to his father. And in verse 31, you can imagine he's excited. He's got this great kill. He's made this stew that his father loves. And he and his father have this phenomenal relationship. We should be thinking something like Abraham and Ishmael before Isaac arrives on the scene. Before Abraham is told Isaac isn't the promised son. Because you remember when God shows up and says, that's not the promised son. What does Abraham do? He begs for blessing on Ishmael anyway. He loves his son. That's Isaac. That's Isaac with his son Esau. So he comes in verse 31. He says, let my father arise and eat of his son's game that you may bless me. He must have been proud, right? Dad, I did it again. Man, you got to taste this. This is better than last time. And now Isaac's perplexed. And in verse 32, he says, who are you? And he answered, I'm your son, your firstborn Esau. And now the wheels behind the blind eyes of Isaac begin to turn. He works his way back through all of the tests that he gave his son. The voice. The stew. And suddenly he realizes what has happened to him. And in verse 33 it tells us, then Isaac trembled very violently and said, who was it then that hunted game and brought it to me? And I ate it all before you came, and I have blessed him. Yes, and he shall be blessed. You see, Isaac can't take back his blessing. There is only one blessing. Esau fully understands this. Just as there was one birthright, and Esau gave it up, and there's no going back on that birthright. So when Isaac gives up his blessing, there's no blessing left. Verse 34, knowing that he can't take it back, as soon as Esau heard the words of his father, he cried out with an exceedingly great and bitter cry and said to his father, bless me even also, O my father. In other words, give me the same blessing. Repeat it and give it to me too. Isaac is in an extreme panic and Esau in extreme distress, and Isaac doesn't mix words about his son Jacob. Verse 35, your brother came deceitfully and he has taken away, literally stolen away, your blessing. Jacob had deceived his blind father and stolen the blessing that Isaac had wanted to give to his favored son Esau. And then Esau in verse 36 says, is he not rightly named Jacob? Remember what Jacob means? Deceiver. Is he not rightly named deceiver? For he cheated me these two times. He took away my birthright, and behold, now he's taken away my blessing. And then grabbing at straws, as it were, then he said, have you reserved no blessing for me? Do you have nothing left? And Isaac responds in verse 37 that, behold, I've made him Lord over you, and all his brothers I've given him for servants. With grain and wine I've sustained him. What then can I do for you, my son? Esau is begging him. I don't know if you can think about the scene, but here's this blind old man laying on his deathbed, his son draped over his bed, tears streaming out of his eyes, and he recognizes he has no birthright and no blessing, and all the land that he thought would be his, all has disappeared. He has lost everything. And now the father that favors him so much is going to die on him. What is left for me to live for, Esau thinks. Verse 38, there's a begging. Have you but one blessing, my father, through tears? Bless me even also, O my father. And Esau lifted up his voice and he wept. Here's this hunter of the field who's always so proud of himself, broken at his father's bedside. And upon hearing the brokenhearted wails of his son, Isaac tries to bless his son with what is left. But the blessings that are left really appear to be negative in their connotation. Verse 39, Isaac, his father, answered him and said, "Behold, away from the fatness of the earth shall your dwelling be, and away from the dew of heaven on high." Jacob's been blessed with all of the fertileness of the land of Canaan. And Esau and his descendants now have been blessed with the desertous and arid region of Edom. Do you remember when they leave Egypt and they're going across the wilderness and they run into Edom, and Edom will not let them pass through their dry and wilderness arid land? The blessing that he gets is you can have everything on the outside edge of the land of Canaan. You can look across the marker of your land and see the fertileness of the soil. That's your blessing. That's all he has left. Jacob has already been promised ruling supremacy, that his brothers will serve him, older and younger will serve. Esau is promised in verse 40, "By your sword you shall live, and you shall serve your brother, but when you grow restless, you shall break his yoke from your neck." So Esau will have to serve his brother. However, there is this ray of hope in blessing for his descendants. Sometime in the future, sometime after Esau's death, when Esau becomes a nation, the nation of Edom, there will come a time when Edom will experience freedom from Israel by breaking Israel's yoke from their necks. And the result of Jacob's deception and these negative blessings upon Esau cause a venomous reaction. Listen to verse 41. "Now Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing which his father had blessed him. And Esau said to himself, 'The days of mourning for my father are approaching, and then I will kill my brother Jacob.'" This statement should take us back to the story of Cain and Abel. Here's the third indication that Esau is not the seed of the woman. While the firstborn, he is not the seed of the woman. First, he has despised his birthright. Second, he has married two Canaanite women who will dispossess the land of Canaan, be cast out of it by God's chosen people. And third, he plans to murder his brother. Like Cain before him, he is the seed of the serpent. This is what Moses is painting for the people of Israel. Esau is the seed of the serpent. However, Jacob has received God's blessing. His descendants will inherit the promised land. He is the seed of the woman through God, through whom God will accomplish all of his redemptive plan. And immediately, as people who value justice and fairness, we shout, "Jacob's a deceiver. This isn't fair. This isn't right." Does God approve of Jacob's deception? God does not approve of Jacob's deception. God's law, all we have to do is go to the Ten Commandments. God's law, which the people of Israel knew, clearly commands and forbids the bearing of false witness. And the narrator shows us that Rebekah and Jacob have not benefited themselves by this deception. As a matter of fact, they've hurt themselves. Rebekah now has to send her son over 400 miles away, and she will die before she ever sees her favored son ever again. Meanwhile, Laban will deceive Jacob by giving him his firstborn daughter, Leah, instead of his beautiful daughter, Rachel. And later, Jacob's sons will deceive their father by claiming that his favorite son, Joseph, did he learn nothing? That his favored son, Joseph, has been killed. And as a proof, they are going to produce Joseph's cloak covered in what? Goat's blood. Jacob deceived his father with goats, and now his sons deceive him with the blood of goats. We need to be clear. The narrator, though, is not trying to point out that God disapproves of deception or that God disapproves of lying. That's clear from the law. There's no need to restate that for the people of Israel getting ready to enter into the promised land. He doesn't need to say once again, oh, by the way, lying's wrong. Bearing false witness is wrong. Deception is wrong. He doesn't need to say that again. So that's not the author's intent of this passage. Rather, the thrust of the author's intent is that God can use sinful deception to accomplish his plan of redemption. God can use sinful deception to accomplish his plan of redemption. Now, when Israel hears this story, Edom's one of their arch enemies, the descendants of Esau. The Edomites were descendants of Esau. With this narrative about Jacob and Esau, Moses is assuring the Israelite people that God has blessed Jacob and not Edom. Do you see that? They've already encountered Edom on the way to the promised land. And now they're standing on the edge of the promised land, and they're questioning whether they're actually victors or conquerors or not, which we looked at in Genesis 25. And now Moses is going to assure them with this story that Edom is not the promised son, but that Jacob is, and Jacob is Israel. And this is their land, and God will give them victory over it. Although Jacob received his blessing by deception, the reality also was that Isaac had no business passing on the covenant blessings of the firstborn to Esau anyway. He was the seed of the serpent. He was not a lover of God. God's plan for redeeming his people and fulfilling his promises and giving them victory cannot even be derailed by sin. This is the central thrust of the story. So if this is the thrust of the story, then how are we to understand this when we come to the New Testament? When did God ever use sinful deception to accomplish his purpose for the redemption of his people, the church? And we only have to look as far as the cross. The greatest deception of all time was the trial of Jesus Christ. At the Last Supper in Matthew chapter 26, verse 24, it tells us, the Son of Man goes as it is written of him. But woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. So in one sense, woe to Judas who betrayed Jesus. It is Judas who betrayed Jesus and sent him to the cross. And in another sense, the reason that Jesus dies is because it is written of him. That God planned to use Judas' deception to accomplish his purpose on the cross. That God put him, his only son, on the cross for us by using Judas and his deception. God uses human deception of Judas to accomplish his plan of redemption to save his people from their sins. Or in Matthew 26, verse 59, we read, the chief priests and the whole council were seeking false testimony against Jesus so that they might put him to death. So what type of testimony are they seeking against Jesus? Deceptive. False testimony. They're seeking liars to bear false testimony about Jesus. And eventually they round up two false witnesses who will speak against Jesus. And we read in verse 66, what is your judgment? And they answered, he deserves death. Here again, God uses the sinful deception of these two witnesses to accomplish his redemptive purposes in saving a people for himself. On the day of Pentecost, Peter preached to a crowd in Acts chapter 2, verses 22 to 24, and he says this, men of Israel, hear these words. Jesus of Nazareth, a man attested to you by God with mighty works and wonders and signs that God did through him in your midst, as you know yourself, or as you yourselves know. This Jesus, delivered up by sinful men, delivered up. It says, by the definite plan and foreknowledge of God, and then he says, you crucified and killed him by the hands of lawless, deceptive, false men. God raised him up, loosing the pains of death because it was not possible for him to be held by it. You see, God used sinful deception to accomplish His plan of redemption. Jesus died to pay the penalty for sin, and He rose again victorious from the grave and ascended to the right hand of the Father to reestablish God's kingdom here on the earth, eventually culminating in the new heaven, new earth, and new Jerusalem. So you say, well, that's great for Jesus. God used deception for Jesus, and He took Him to the cross, and He saved us. That's fine, but how in the world do you get life application out of this for us? How is the church to understand a passage like this, that God uses sinful deception to accomplish His redemptive purposes of saving people for Himself? How am I supposed to live in light of that truth? Let me give you a couple. Number one, when people deceive you, now I'm going to add a bunch of stuff beyond that, okay? So you can just write "when people deceive you," and then I'll give you the rest. When people deceive you, when people lie to you, when people lie about you, when people speak falsely about you, when people hurt you because of their lack of truthfulness, we should understand, here's what you can write, we should understand that God is using this to make us more like Him. And that's a hard truth. We say, I want to be like Jesus. And then, when we're treated like Jesus, people lie about us, say false things about us, hurt our reputation, call into question our character. We say, that must be of Satan. But have we ever considered that this is how God is forming us to be like Him? Have we ever considered that God is using someone else who's false and deceptive to make us like Him? Think about, we're not there yet. We will be soon, in my estimation of soon. Genesis chapter 50. Let's back up here for a second. I didn't put it in. All right, I'll just give it to you. Genesis chapter 50, verse 20. Genesis 50, 20. As for you, now remember, this is Joseph and his brothers. What did his brothers do to him? Beat him up, poured goat's blood on his nice coat, threw him in a pit, sold him into slavery. We know all the events that happened inside of Joseph's life, and they are a sordid detail of events, being charged with rape, being thrown in prison twice. What is Joseph's response to his deceptive brothers who meant to harm him and do evil to him? God says, Joseph says, as for you, you meant it for evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many should be kept alive as they are today. Boy, we just have no idea what God is doing through the episodes in our life to bring us to culminating events like providing for Israel so they don't cease to exist in starvation in the promised land. Had this not happened to Joseph, Jacob's household would have died. But because it happened, God's people were spared. Have you ever considered that God may be bringing people into your life which falsely accuse you, so that in your godly response, in your righteous response to deceptive people, it would prove to be a witness to both unbelievers and believers alike. One, to believers, so they can say, he's truly a believer. She's truly a believer. Because the only way that someone responds with that kindness and that grace when they're being accused like that is if they truly have the Spirit in them, which is teaching them love and joy and peace and patience and kindness and goodness and gentleness and self-control, against which there is no law. It shows you to be a believer to other believers, which is an encouragement to them and a bolstering of you. And it speaks volumes to unbelievers who say, why in the world would you act that way towards vicious people? And you can say, they may mean it for evil, but God meant it for good. Or you can say, like Jesus Christ, God forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. We are being made like Christ when we are falsely accused. We also need to remember that this is not point two, this is a continuation of point one. God always does ultimate good to his children. We think that falsity and deception will always be evil to us, but God always means it for good. If we as evil earthly fathers know how to give good gifts to our children, how much more our Heavenly Father gives good gifts to those who ask of him. God means this for our good. 2. Have you ever been concerned that you've blown your testimony in front of your friends, in front of your coworkers, in front of your family so badly that you have finally and ultimately chased them away from God? That you have done something so sinful that they will never, ever believe in Jesus Christ because of your actions. This passage reassures us this is impossible. This is impossible. Just look at Jacob. He was a deceiver. He stole. His father despised him as a deceiver. His brother hated him and wanted to kill him. And remember, he's the guy who's dealing with all the business dealings of his family. This isn't something that's happening privately. This is something that the entire community knows. If the head of the household has to go 400 miles away to save his life, guess what? The community's talking. This isn't private. This isn't among 3 or 4 people. This is among all the descendants of Abraham and Isaac. This is not isolated to family. And by the way, Jacob is responsible for the spiritual dealings in his family at this point. So here is the spiritual head of Israel as Isaac fades. Yet God would not allow the sinful, deceptive actions of one of his people to stop his plan of redemption. God is going to save the nations, and God is not going to stop from saving people, not even if his own people sin. His plan will not be stopped. It will not be thwarted. What an encouragement for us today that we cannot stop God from redeeming people, which means even when we blow it, that we are continuing to give great testimony to our great God, who should say, I'm done with you, it's over, you're a deceiver, you're a liar, you're a cheat, you're an adulterer, whatever it is, and there's all these accusing fingers pointing at us when God should give up on us. God's great grace comes to us, and we, in need of grace, cry out to God, and in spite of our sin, God draws people to himself anyway. It's always in spite of us, it's never because of us. Don't stop sharing the gospel because you've blown it. Rather, speak to your need of grace of God and how forgiving he is when you blow it, and testify to his greatness anyway. Because God is going to continue to draw people to himself, and you can't make him not do it. God, not in a sacrilegious way, stands in heaven and says, you can't make me. We're like, did we just stop you from doing this? Nope. Because you can't stop me from drawing people to myself. What an encouragement to us. Because I got to tell you, I've blown it in front of family. And I've blown it in front of friends. And I've thought to myself, am I the reason that that person is going to go to hell? And God says, in my sovereignty, I'm drawing people to myself. And you can't stop me, not even if you sin. By the way, not permission to go out and sin. That's not what's being communicated here. Not permission to go deceive because God uses deception, but rather to thank God that he's transforming us by his grace into Christ's likeness. This gives us more reason to be like God, not more reason to not be like him. Third, you may be discouraged today like the Israelites were discouraged. They didn't have possession of the promised land, and they began to doubt whether God would ever give them the promised land. Maybe you're like the Israelites. You've seen the effects of sin on this world. You've seen deception and dishonesty that are inherent in this world. You, for a long time, have been longing for the return of Jesus Christ, for the new heaven, new earth, and new Jerusalem, when God comes and sets his kingdom on this earth. And you're beginning to wonder whether God will ever ultimately give us the promised land, whether God will actually ever set up his new earth. This message also comes as an encouragement to us this morning. In the midst of the curse upon this world, God is using the sinful deception that we see and so grieves our hearts to accomplish His redemptive plan. And His good plan cannot fail. The gospel is going out to all nations. And when every tongue and tribe and nation and language is represented, God will return in all of His glory. So if you think that God is slow, it's only because He's redeeming people. It's only because He's accomplishing His purposes. He's not slow. As we count slowness, He's right on time. And He's redeeming people for Himself. Matthew 24:14. Also not in there. Matthew 24:14. And the gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the whole world as a testimony to all nations. And then the end will come. And lastly, and maybe even most difficultly, as we sang this morning, things like Take My Life and Let It Be, or I lift my arms high and heart abandoned. I surrender all. Are we surrendered to the plan of God, even if it requires struggle and suffering for a time? Have we surrendered ourselves to the sovereign providential plan of God, even if it causes suffering for a time? Listen to these words again. They're not to be taken lightly. All to Jesus I surrender. All to Him I freely give. I will ever love and trust Him. Do you hear that? Fighting to believe the promises of God there. I will trust Him. In His presence daily live. I surrender all. I surrender all. All to Thee, my blessed Savior. I surrender all. Have we surrendered all to Jesus this morning?